This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. I was intrigued by the Sunday New York Times Magazine. In fact, let me bounce a couple of these statistics off of you, Michael Miller. Thanks for joining us. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really well, John. What do you have?
Well, there's lots that you and I need to talk about, but I just wanted to mention this. Michael Miller's on the line, the Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University, and the magazine issue this Sunday was about the billionaires in this country, how many of them there are, what their wealth is like. And so they did a ways to compare Jeff Bezos's wealth to the wealth of the average person. They said, for instance, the median U.S. household net worth is $118,000. I'm surprised it's that small. The median U.S. household net worth is $118,000, and he's worth, when they went to press, $172 billion. How does that compare? They said, if your personal wealth was the size of a white blood cell, his size would be a finback whale. He would be
a whale
if you were a white blood cell. I'll just give you one more. He said, the height, if your personal wealth, on average, were the height of a piece of Toblerone chocolate, those little triangular-shaped little tiny chocolates, that's your wealth. His wealth would be Mount Everest if you climbed it five times.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, one more. These are fun.
That is stunning.
or depressing. The average full-time Amazon employee, made $37,930 in 2020. In order to accumulate as much money as Jeff Bezos has, $172 billion, I know that's a ridiculous thought process, but let's do it. The average full-time employee makes $37,900. In order to accumulate as much wealth as Bezos has, an employee would have had to start working in the Pliocene epoch 4.5 million years ago when hominids just started standing on 2 feet.
Oh, my.
Sir, your thoughts. Your thoughts, sir.
Well, I tell you, there is one, positive side to the comparison.
Yeah.
Is that if you compare people not by their wealth but by their consumption, the difference between Bezos and you and me is not as dramatic. He has a bigger house, or he has many houses, but you have a house. He has many cars, expensive cars, but you have a car and you have a microwave. And so it turns out that when we compare people by their consumption, not by their wealth or their income, Americans are much more evenly distributed. Much more even across the board than it is when you look at wealth. But that doesn't change the fact that that many billions of dollars is a stunning number, for sure.
Maybe it doesn't matter then. Maybe consumption is a better metric to gauge people's happiness or satisfaction than their accumulation of acreage, which he has a lot of.
Yeah, see, I happen to think that way. As long as he got his money legally, you know, if someone becomes very, very rich and they do it through illegal means, that's where I have a real problem. And in the old days, we, of course, had major differences between people based upon race and sex, like because there were Jim Crow laws and things like that that stopped certain people. But I'm not so concerned about Bezos if he did it providing a product people want, and he did it legally. That's good for him. But again, he can only eat so many meals. He can only buy so many cars and enjoy them. And so consumption, to me, is a much better way to look at it.
I'm a little more anti-billionaire maybe than you sound, in that I don't think that our economic system, our version of capitalism, is woven into the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. We have this sort of American ideal as expressed by our economics. And I think, well, we make the rules. And I wonder if in doing so, we've made the rules in a way that favors a few and isn't good enough to the many. You know, there's nothing automatic or inherently right about our economic system. It's a moving thing. And maybe the fact that somebody like that controls that much wealth should be a red flag to us.
I hear what you're saying. You know, there is a group of economists who are, I guess we would say, they would be libertarian type economists. And what they would argue is that you should never, that a system like socialism or something where you would take a larger and larger percentage of money from people who become very rich always involves force, whereas capitalism is one that doesn't. It is the free interaction of free people making decisions in their own best interest. And so I have this discussion with my students many times that one thing that I have a fair number of students who have socialist leanings. And one thing that they don't recognize is when government wants to take from you, it's a matter of force. And capitalism, in its general form, is one that does not involve nearly as much. It doesn't involve force. It's a free interaction between people.
But it's not when we subsidize businesses or allow write-offs to large companies. I mean, or have Social Security. We have socialism in our every fabric of every day.
Sure. Oh, I agree that there. But we don't want to confuse socialism with a welfare. I guess we'd use that expression, welfare state. That's what Scandinavia says. A lot of people say, well, Scandinavia is socialist and they do well. And they answer back, no, we're not socialist. We're capitalist. But we have a large welfare state, and we pay for it by taxing people at a very, very high rate, and they buy into it. But it is capitalist in that the government doesn't control prices. They don't own the capital. They allow their companies to expand or to fail. And there's much less force in capitalism than there is in socialism.
Surely, but I think the most important thing you just said is they buy into it. I don't know that.
That's exactly right. Yes,
we are ready to buy.
They have a population.
Well, the Finns.
I don't know if we were ready to buy into that.
Are you
willing?
Am I willing to do so? I don't know, because I would take a hit. But the people in Finland are happier than the people in the United States by every measure. So I wonder if maybe we couldn't learn something from that. I have to pause for a second, Professor, and then let's talk about some of the other things you came to the table with as well. On a phone line on the Wintrust Business Lunch, we're talking to Michael Miller, an associate professor of economics at DePaul. Professor, did you know that if your personal wealth were 57 degrees sweater weather, Jeff Bezos' wealth would be the equivalent of the center of the sun? So I don't know.
That's
interesting.
Helps,
but there's that.
Nah.
Okay, let's talk about something else. You mentioned to producer Pete something about the monetary policy, inflation that everybody's talking about. Kind of help me put this in perspective.
Okay, here's what happened. The Fed, of course, by law, has to create stable prices and maximum employment. It's called the dual mandate. And any time that, say, in the past 20, 30 or 40 years, when inflation would begin to rise, before it would even rise, the Fed would step in, raise interest rates, slow down the economy, and keep us in a period of low price, low inflation, and good employment. This time, based upon some graphs I've seen and some data, the Fed completely missed how bad the inflation was going to be. Not only did they get wrong the amount of inflation, but they got wrong how long the inflation would last. So when we were talking about a month ago, the question was, will the Fed raise interest rates 0.25% or 0.5%? And they decided to go with 0.25% because they thought, oh, that's probably enough. And now almost everybody in the Fed is talking about we're going to have to not only raise rates 0.5%, but when it's all over, we're going to have to raise them higher to try to stop this inflation from getting worse. Now, here's the problem. You and I are going to have, of course, the consequences of those high interest rates when it comes to car loans and credit cards and so forth. And on top of it, the idea of trying to slow down an economy that has inflation, what you want to achieve is that the economy get through the inflation yet still continue to grow with strong employment. And that's what is called a soft landing. And it turns out that if the Fed moves before the inflation starts, they can do it. They can create a soft landing. But never in history has the Fed been able to raise interest rates to stop existing inflation without pushing us into a recession. So the outlook is becoming, the recession outlook is becoming a problem to most people.
the Fed is people. It's these governors and the Fed chair. So who are they? Who appointed them? And should we throw the bums out?
Well, the Board of Governors, they're appointed by the president and then ratified by the Senate. And they cannot be fired except for cause, if they would rob a bank or something like that. And they have very long terms. They have 14-year terms if they decide to stay. And so, no, we can't throw out those people. The other group are the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. Those 12 people are chosen by the district banks, you know, like the Chicago district. They've chosen Charlie Evans. You and I would have no say, and it would take the banks of the Chicago region to throw Charlie Evans out of his particular job. Now, Charlie's not making any mistakes that I know of. It's just that the group as a whole, when they try to decide where is the economy going, their forecasts have just been wrong. And because forecasting is really, really hard.
Do you blame? Yeah, well, that's it. Forecasting is hard. I wonder if that reflects a certain political or economic ideology that is the wrong one, or is it just evidence that it's really hard to know what to do?
It's really hard to know what to do. And I think economics is one of the most wonderful disciplines for understanding what happens within the world of exchange and so forth. But we have no great insight when it comes to forecasting the future, especially when you get something like a pandemic or a war, the first large war in Europe in, 70 years. And these kinds of things will throw curveballs to anybody. But the Fed did make one mistake. Let's put it this way. When the government decided to spend all that money on the pandemic to help people out, which I think was, you and I talked about this, was the right thing. The more targeted, the better. But the Fed had two choices. They could have allowed interest rates to rise, or they could have bought up all of the stuff that the Fed, that the government was issuing, the new debt, to keep interest rates low. But that increases the money supply and raises the probability of inflation. And what the Fed did was that they kept interest rates low because they feared that the economy would crash during the pandemic even further if they didn't do this. So they were kind of in a bind, but they have somewhat set up this problem, that they have created the situation with the money supply so high and demand so high that inflation is going to be very hard to stop without raising interest rates really high, which could easily lead to a recession.
I wonder which is the worst of the two choices, huh?
Well, I'll tell you, economists have struggled with this. What is worse, high inflation or high unemployment? I'll always go that high unemployment is worse because it has a very personal effect on the people who are unemployed. Yeah. So that's why there are some people who are, they're called hawks and doves, those who do not fear inflation as much as others are inflation doves. And it appears that the Board of Governors tends to be a little more dovish when it comes to inflation, but the 12 presidents tend to be hawkish. And so they do have differences of opinion during their meetings to try to decide what to do with interest rates.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Always a pleasure, Michael. Thanks for giving us some of your time today.
It was my pleasure, John. You take care.
Dialed into the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. John Williams here with Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. ChicagoInno.com is their website. Hey, Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Lots of interesting stories you've been writing about lately. Let's start with this one. Quincy Jones, Doja Cat join A-list investor lineup and a music startup called Songfinch. I know a little bit about this, but get us started. What's going on here?
Yeah, so for musicians, the path to launching a career in the business used to mean moving to Los Angeles, moving to Nashville, moving to New York City, and sort of, putting in your hours there, going from gig to gig, trying to build your craft and earn a little bit of a living. But Songfinch here based in Chicago, a startup that has created a platform that actually lets you sort of do that from your home studio. It's a platform for musicians to connect with fans and let fans request personalized songs. So think birthday, an anniversary, a Valentine's Day. If you want to make a personalized song for somebody, you can find one of the musicians on Songfinch's platform and tell them a little bit about what kind of song you want them to make, give them some lyrics perhaps, and sort of let them take the creative freedom away. And then for about $200, and in about a week, they'll turn an original song around for you. This is a platform that launched a few years ago, but really has hit its stride in recent years, and just last week actually raised $5 million from some of those investors that you mentioned, like Quincy Jones and Doja Cat. The Weeknd is an investor in the startup as well. Atlantic Records CEO Craig Coleman, a lot of big names behind this company, which has now got a catalog of about 1,000 musicians on its platform. And just in the last couple quarters alone, they did 40,000 original songs.
So The Weeknd isn't recording the songs. I wonder how good the music is or how noteworthy the musicians are.
So right now, it's definitely that the bulk of it is aspiring musicians. These are folks who are still cutting their teeth in the business, working their way up. But, you know, Scott Catoon, the co-founder, told me that, you know, eventually they think that they can become a platform that's sort of like the Cameo for songs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Cameo, of course, a Chicago company that lets you connect with, you know, A-list celebrities and B-list and C-list and get a hello message from them. And, you know, they kind of think that they can open up their platform to more well-known musicians as well, who can, you know, create these little one-off original tunes for folks too. So I'm not sure how long it will be before The Weeknd is on the platform, if ever, but right now it's definitely that aspiring group, and they are looking to tap into more established musicians potentially down the road.
Scott used to do a radio show here on weekends, a tech show, and it was actually really dialed in. Was it Technori? Yeah, Technori. And maybe we should invite him on, because here's what I want to do. I want to write my own song. I don't know anything about music, but I think a lot of us know what we want to say, or we've written a poem or something. We'd like it set to music. I wonder if they'll do it that way.
Absolutely. And, you know, Scott told me, you know, one piece of the equation here, too, down the road, too, is, you know, connecting musicians with different specialties to create original music, right? So it's not necessarily just fancy musician, but, you know, if, hey, if I play the guitar and you play the keys, I give you a little bit of something I'm working on, you can work on the piano part, and we can kind of collaborate that way, too. So that's a definitely a piece of Songfinch down the road.
Talk to me about this startup that wants to put a shipping container in people's yards.
Yeah, so this is a company in Chicago called SI Container Builds, and they are jumping on the trend that, you know, we started to see a bit across the country now of using shipping containers as dwellings, and you've seen some housing development kind of come up with these shipping containers built to kind of create homes. And, you know, what they're doing is a little bit different. So they actually, you know, are doing the housing development as well, but they also focus on kind of backyard dwellings. So think if you wanted to put a home office extension in your backyard, if you wanted to make a pool house, if you wanted to make a little at-home studio, they will do that with a shipping container. So they source shipping containers. These are containers that are previously, you know, on the ship, on the seas, carrying goods from China, and they are repurposed into these different use cases. And so SI Container Builds just the other week raised a little bit of money from Hyde Park Angels and some other investors to basically open up this brand new warehouse in Buffalo Grove where they're going to be manufacturing these and delivering the containers to folks.
Buddy of mine wants a swimming pool made out of those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, what they see is, you know, it's environmentally friendly, right? So rather than sending these shipping containers off, you know, to be discarded, so it's certainly repurposed and a little bit greener. And, you know, what they've sort of specialized to is making them look less like a shipping container, right? So they can put, you know, they can match the, you know, the stucco that's on the outside of your house on the shipping container. You know, they can make it sort of mimic, you know, the style and feel of your actual home, and so it makes it feel a little less industrial.
Are we going to be more scootered up than other cities? We're going to be more scootered up than we used to be, right?
That's right. So, yeah, Chicago, the scooters are coming back. They're coming back in May. The city announced last week that around 4,000 scooters were going to be available from four different operators, including Divvy. You know, Chicago has definitely been slower than some cities to adopt scooters. This is actually the first program that Chicago will have that's not temporary. So it's two pilot programs initially ran in Chicago to do scooters starting back in 2019. This is the first program that's actually multi-year. So this is a two-year plan to have scooters out in Chicago streets. And yeah, Chicago certainly has not led the way in scooters. There's definitely been some skepticism with scooters, and rightfully so. But what Chicago is doing, interestingly enough, is taking some smart approaches, I think, to reducing clutter and making these just more accessible. So each of the scooters are going to have some tether technology to lock these things to certain structures so they're not cluttering the sidewalks. And actually, they're going to have a technology that keeps them from riding on sidewalks altogether. So you'll be able to ride these scooters on sidewalks. You'll have to ride them in the appropriate ways. But Chicago, is certainly warming up to scooters now here with this 2-year program.
If the technology does what you say it will do, I think that's really smart. You wrote that they will not be allowed on the Lakefront Trail, the 606, the Riverwalk, or Navy Pier. They don't even let you ride a bicycle on Navy Pier. So that sounds like, while that's frustrating at times for those of us that like to ride bicycles on Navy Pier, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's going to be a big piece of the puzzle, right, to getting folks back downtown as well. As the weather warms up and the city opens up a bit. So hopefully this will be just yet another mode of transportation to help people, explore more of Chicago.
You can read more by Jim Dahlke and friends at ChicagoWinnow.com. Jim's the senior editor at Chicago Winnow. Nice to talk to you, Jim. Well done.
Thanks, John.
WGN Radio News continues now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago startup that wants to insure your watches and engagement rings just had a strong funding round. Brightco pulled in $9 million in a Series A round. The company hopes to take on insurance giants like State Farm and Nationwide with its tech-focused solution that it claims will cover your jewelry for less. Brightco lets customers receive a custom insurance quote in a few minutes online and coverage within minutes. The funding round was led by Brand Foundry Ventures, Hyde Park Angels, and Western Technology Investment. The Wall Street Journal reports a judge has appointed mediators to help resolve a $2 billion lawsuit against former Sears chairman Eddie Lampert. The 2019 lawsuit filed by Sears Holdings against Lampert alleges Lampert, his hedge fund ESL Investments, and others took billions of dollars in assets from Sears before it declared bankruptcy. Sears filed for bankruptcy protection in 2018. Lampert bought the company in 2004 and made several failed attempts to turn the company around. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time and Steve Alexander.
John, has Bernadette been introduced to goldfish yet? The kind that you eat, not the kind you swim?
She certainly has.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a bad thing? I hope I'm not going to regret this.
No, I was just surprised to hear how long they've been around. They are celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. And I don't remember them as a kid, so maybe I was deprived of as a child. Who knows? But via advertising, these things are getting a reboot.
New Goldfish Megabytes. The bigger, bolder, cheesier Goldfish reboot.
If you don't like goldfish, your teenager probably does. A survey shows they are American teens' most preferred snack, and the company that makes them, Pepperidge Farm, cranks out nearly 150 billion of those little fishies each year. So far, they appear to be fairly immune to inflation. One variety or another always seems to be on sale. But for other food, a United Nations survey shows food inflation surged faster than ever last month, 13%, and is now up more than 50% since mid-2020. But keep in mind, that is worldwide. We've got it much better here in the United States. The USDA says on average, over the last 20 years, food prices have risen 2 to 3% per year. But in the first 2 months of this year, prices went up 1% each month, and the USDA is raising its forecast for how much more we're going to have to pay, on average, this year over last year. Here's Matt McLaughlin, an economist with the USDA.
Food away from home prices will increase between 5.5 and 6.5%. Food at home, we are predicting that for the whole year, they will be between 3 and 4% above where they were last year.
Again, those are averages. And there are some eye-popping increases last year to this year in some categories. Beef leading the way at 16% over last year. Poultry, 12% higher because
we have historically low volumes of stored chicken meat.
He says fresh fruit is the next biggest gainer, up about 10%, dairy about 5%, and eggs 4.5% higher. All of that is without factoring in the Russian attack on Ukraine.
We will have to wait and see exactly what those impacts are going to be.
From the farm to your belly, today is National Cheese Fondue Day, and based on what we just heard, it will cost you about 5% more to celebrate this year than it did last year. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We click on Amy Guth to catch us up on, let's start with Elon Musk today. What's on your radar, Amy?
That's exactly right. So, you and I had talked earlier about how he has complained for a very long time about Twitter and Twitter's features and had even accused them of maybe not being on the side of free speech even. So, but then he bought a stake in the company, bought about 9.2% of the company, and he was set to join the board over the weekend. So fast forward to the weekend, Twitter CEO Parag Agrawal tweeted that he will not be joining the board. And his message on Twitter was a little strange because it was some of it seemed a bit cryptic. He warned employees of distractions ahead and not to pay any attention to them and just to kind of go full steam ahead. And so a lot of industry watchers and people working in the finance world and have been kind of speculating on what that could mean today, that Elon Musk is not joining the board. And some of that, it remains to be seen. We don't know. Of course, we have to just wait and see. But some industry watchers and some advisors in that space have kind of been speculating that maybe it was partly because of the limit that was placed on his ownership. By joining the board, he couldn't own more than about 14% of the company, that maybe he's looking to buy more of it. Maybe he's looking to do something a little bolder, kind of fitting in his character. But we'll have to wait and see. But for now, he is not joining the board.
Yeah. Talk to me about beef jerky. That's a hard segue. We'll just go from that to beef jerky prices and ConAgra. What's the latest there?
Yeah, that's right. So ConAgra said that they expect to spend about 50% more on meat-based ingredients this year. And when you think of all the stuff that ConAgra has, that's from snacks like Slim Jim jerky to healthy choice frozen meals, that's a lot. So spending about 50% more on ingredients, Bloomberg reported that they were kind of changing their forecast a little bit. That translates to about $340 million more spent on meat than they really planned to, according to some statements last week. But they're not the only ones. Portillo's also had changed their forecast a little bit. They had it about 7% up, but they've changed it now, expecting commodity inflation as much as 15% higher this year. And particularly, they named significant increases in meat costs. So we'll see how this affects other companies, but there's two Chicago-based companies right there that are already kind of seeing the impact of that. ConAgra said that they are increasing their prices, but it's going to take a little while to see that filter through to the bottom line. But you know, more things to be thinking about at the grocery store right now, for sure.
There's going to be a new filter on Snapchat.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. Sometimes, you know, we see stories about technology and some dangerous things, and we've been talking about risks of cybercrime and things like that. But here's a really, really positive use of technology, and that is a filter on Snapchat last week. This was reported by CNET. They're promoting people learning American Sign Language and the alphabet through this filter. So you essentially turn this filter on, and, you know, if you played with a Snapchat filter, you can, like, put the dog ears on yourself or do different faces, things like that. But in this filter, it will kind of zero in on your hand as you're spelling out things, and it will teach you how to spell your name and teach you and kind of check you as you're doing that. So it's sort of a teaching tool that I think is really interesting. And it was developed by a team of deaf and hard of hearing Snapchat staff members, and they've rolled this out. It's been out about a week or so, and it's part of a lens that was launched in partnership with SignAll, which is a startup that uses AI to translate sign language in real time for you know, virtual meetings and things like that. So I think there's a lot of potential here, and it's very interesting just as a communication tool to have this other layer to allow more people to participate in conversations who otherwise, you know, might have trouble doing so.
This reminds me of what Steve Alexander asked me a moment ago about my granddaughter Bernadette, who doesn't talk yet. She's just a little over a year old, and she's in a little daycare class of other kids who aren't verbal yet, but the kids use hand signs to communicate with the teacher and vice versa. So when they are done eating, they put their hands in the air and wiggle their wrists back and forth. And when they want more food or snack or whatever it is they're doing, there's another gesture, and the kids know how to communicate, but they're using hand signs instead of talking. I've never seen that. I thought, what a smart, clever idea. The kids, it's all working under there. They just haven't gone to translating it verbally, you know?
Right, right. I think a lot of people do teach babies sign language, especially words like more when they want more food, things like that. And I think it's very interesting to, you know, you have this opportunity to expose young minds to language and different communication tools. It's very fascinating to watch babies' minds as they kind of pick up new skills.
Boy, we're doing that at my place. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for your help today, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.